From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Back in 1992, I first saw what became one of my all-time favorite episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation. It was called The Inner Light. And it ends with Captain Picard, alone in his quarters, playing an alien flute. Commander Riker has just asked the captain if he's okay.
Yes, thank you. But I find that I'm having to rediscover that this is really my home.
You see, Picard had just spent 25 minutes unconscious on the bridge of the Enterprise. An alien probe had aimed a mysterious beam at his brain. And in those few minutes, the captain had experienced, he'd lived an entirely different lifetime on an alien planet. He had loved, married, had children. He learned to play the flute. But none of it was real. It had all happened in his head. Just like what happened to Dorothy.
It was a place. And you were there.
Oh, sure.
But you couldn't have been, could you?
Oh, we dream lots of silly things when we...
No, Aunt Em. This was a real, truly live place.
Was it? Just like what Morpheus revealed to Neo.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
The Matrix.
It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
What truth?
What truth? Well, whether it's an alien nucleonic beam, or a twister-induced dream, or a computer jacked directly into your brainstem, Hollywood, the original Dream Factory, really loves this question. How can you trust what your brain tells you, or even insists to you, is true? Well, this week, we are exploring the idea, the concept of truth. What it is, how we perceive it, how it's controlled and manipulated, and what all that means today. And we're doing this series in a collaboration with the nonprofit journalism group, TheConversation.com. And today, the actual neural matrix that is your brain and how it perceives, judges, and misjudges what is true. So joining us first today to help us explore this question is Jay Van Bavel. He's joining us from New York. He's a professor of psychology and neuroscience at New York University and director of the Social Identity and Morality Lab. He studies brains, human brains, and the way we all interact with the world, especially as it relates to truth. Jay Van Bavel, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me here.
It's great to have you. So first of all, I wonder if you might just give us a little tour of our gray matter. Like, imagine that you've slid us into the MRI or the fMRI. What are the different parts of the brain that are important to understand when it comes to our processing of truth?
Yeah, the first thing that's important is thinking about sensation. So humans have five senses, vision, touch, taste, smell, and hearing. And depending on what we're presented with, it affects the sensory cortices associated with that type of sense. So right now, people are listening to us. They're hearing the information come in through their ears. It's being sent as electrical signals in their auditory cortex. And then they're trying to make a sense, often through visualization and memory and other parts of the brain, to understand the concepts that we're discussing online on the radio right now.
Okay. And so Go ahead.
I was going to say, so that's the first phase. So most of sensation is how we experience the world as long as our senses are intact. The next stage, and this is where truth can be debated far more, is at perception. That we might hear something, but you and I might have different interpretations of what we heard. So this came out with a lot of great illusions. One of the most recent ones that went viral was Laurel versus Yanny. I'm not sure if you heard that one, but the same sound is interpreted differently by different people. And so somehow the sensation is working, but the perceptions are far off.
Oh, I see. It was like the auditory version of the blue dress, silver dress viral moment on the internet. I got you. So then when, for example, when the brain is the perception one, we'll get to that in a moment. But when the brain is processing something that's true, like, for example, I have a cup of tea here next to me. It is true that it is there. What does it look like in my brain that processing action.
Yeah, so a lot of things are happening in your brain. So if you're looking at the T, that information goes in through your eyes to the back of your brain to the visual cortex, and you start to represent the size of the cup, the colors, maybe how much tea is in it. You might start to have a sensation of how warm it is if you actually reach out and put your hand on it, or if you can see steam coming off. You start to get representations in your motor cortex that help guide you to reach out so you can grasp it and then bring it up and drink it. And then that hits your tongue, and your tongue has different ways of sensing whether it's sweet or bitter or sour as you drink it. And so that hit a number of sensations, just that one cup of tea, and then all of them are getting integrated in your mind to determine, did you like it? Because you have to determine, did it look good? Did it smell good? Did it taste good? Did it have a good aftertaste? So all of those things are getting integrated, and that's affecting your memory, and you might decide, I don't want to buy that type of tea next time I go to the local cafe, or I might want to. It might be the best tea you've ever had. And so all of these different brain regions are working together to build that understanding of whether you like the tea or not, but it just starts at the most basic level of what you're seeing and tasting and smelling.
Okay, so say someone then handed me a cup that looked similar, perhaps the color of the liquid inside were different, and they said, here's a cup of tea. And I drank it, but it turns out it's not tea. It's like fake tea, I guess. Is how my brain would process that any different than how it processes the information surrounding the actual true cup of tea?
Yeah, so you might have a contradiction between different senses based on what you expect. And so the visual senses that you're getting are telling you what to expect to taste. But then by the time you taste it, it's conflicting with what your visual perception was telling you to expect, and therefore it can be a conflict. It can actually lead to you to kind of viscerally react and push it away or spit it out of your mouth if it's something that you weren't expecting.
Okay. Well, in this case, I would have other sensory input for me to sort of test my theories about what tea is supposed to be. But I, from my understanding, there seems to be a body of evidence or experiments that show when it comes to, say, facts, that it's hard to sometimes tell the difference in the brain when it's processing something that's true or processing something that's fake if you didn't know that it was fake.
Yeah, so our brain often starts with the assumption that what we're sensing is reality, in part because we need to have a layout of what's around us to survive. You know, I'm in Manhattan. If I can't see a car coming down the street and I walk out in the road, and I would be dead instantly. So that's not a very adaptive way for the brain to work. So for the most part, the senses that we have are pretty accurate and can tell us, you know, what's in our environment, where to sit down, whether we're interacting with another person. And it does a good job of that, which is why we're able to live as long as we do and, you know, make it to this our work today. But there are moments where it breaks down or gets confused, where the expectations are working differently, or it's attached to something that we really value. Like I read a headline in the news that's really upsetting and I don't want to believe it. And so that's often from later things that kick online and help us interpret reality that can lead us to reject true things or believe false things.
Okay. Well, so folks, we are talking this hour about how the brain processes truth, processes lies or fiction, like literally what's going on inside our heads when we are presented with truth versus falsehoods. Now, Jay, so what I hear you saying is that we don't actually have brains that are really built well for the current world we're living in. Is that too extreme a statement?
Yeah. So, I mean, a good way of thinking about our brains is that they evolved in the savanna of Africa to solve a certain set of problems. And those were interactions with other people, you know, getting food, raising children. And now we're in a different environment with media and social media and interacting with strangers from different parts of the world. And a lot of these things, our brain didn't fully evolve to address. And so we can take shortcuts or make mistakes that might have worked for our ancestors, but don't necessarily work for us and can lead us astray at times.
Well, so are the brains that we have, these very big brains actually in comparison to the rest of the animal world, but they're built really well for sensory input and also for social interaction. I mean, isn't that a big part of the story here?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought it up. Again, if you think back to how our ancestors lived, they lived in small groups and they could easily be picked off for lunch by roaming lions. And so the things that we did that made us successful and flourish and spread around the world were our ability to communicate and cooperate with other people and fit into social communities that were important to us. And so the social world to us is the type of reality that matters most often for our survival and for our quality of life and well-being.
And so, therefore, are we more likely to believe things that are told to us from members of our social groups?
Yeah, that's the people that pass on the information that we trust. And you have to think, in the modern world, there are so many issues that we can't possibly know. So for a personal experience here, I tried to read up on climate change by reading the original scientific articles. And I have a PhD, I'm a professor, and I couldn't understand it. So I have to trust the institution of science and the peer review process and the other experts working on it who've gone through rigorous training to get a sense of what the reality is in that topic, other than, going back to school for 5 more years myself to try to understand it. And so we place a lot of trust in institutions and people around us. And that's really the only way to wrap our mind around so many complex issues that are going on in the world today.
Well, I mean, I was just going to ask you, what other choice do we have, right? And so that trust can be exploited. And we're going to, that's going to be the topic of our the third part of our series tomorrow. But we got to take a quick break here, Jay. We are talking about how the brain processes truth and also how it processes lies or fiction as well. It's part two of our special week-long series on truth. And Jay Van Bavel joins us. He's an associate professor of psychology and neuroscience at New York University. We have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, it's part two of our special series about truth. It's a series that we've produced in collaboration with the nonprofit journalism organization, TheConversation.com. And today we're talking about how the brain processes truth. Like, really, what's actually happening in various parts of your brain when we're trying to figure out what's real and what's not. And Jay Van Bavel joins us today. He's an associate professor of psychology and neuroscience at New York University and director of the Social Identity and Morality Lab. And Jay, if I could, I actually just want to listen back to a moment that we had in yesterday's show. It was part one of our series when we talked about how ancient cultures thought about truth. And we spoke to Joel Christensen. He was a professor of classics at Brandeis University. And he mentioned an ancient Greek scholar and his theories on how we process truth.
But where multiplicity comes in and where diversity really matters is that we all have different bodies.
Uh-huh.
And what Epicurus also notes is that our experiences of the world and our memories of it change the way we interpret our senses. So who you are in the world based on gender or race or religion actually changes the way you sense the world.
So that was Joel Christensen yesterday in part one of our series about truth. Jay, I mean, Epicurus was circa a couple of thousand years ago. How far off was he in terms of how we process what's true?
Yeah, it turns out that modern science is converging with that assumption. We now have lots of evidence from different directions that our identities and experiences and values shape how we interpret the world around us in pretty basic ways.
And basic ways meaning how? Tell me more. What do you mean?
Okay. So I'll give you a couple examples. So we already mentioned the dress that some people saw as black and blue and other people saw as white and gold. I personally see it as black and blue. But people are very split over that. And I have a colleague at NYU who found out that it turns out part of the explanation about why people disagree is whether you're a morning or an evening person. So morning people are used to seeing shadows fall on things a different way, and their brain automatically makes assumptions about how light or dark something is based on those assumptions about the shadows. And so just your sleep schedule can change your interpretations of the color of things. So that's a fun example. But then if you go into domains like where morality and identity are involved, there's lots of research showing that, you know, if you go to any sports stadium, you'll see fans from both teams arguing over whether a foul should be called or a penalty should be applied to a player. Well, there's famous studies showing with college football teams, you know, fighting with one another. They show the tape of the game to fans from the different schools, and they recall and perceive different numbers of fouls committed by each team. So people start to disagree on basic facts of the game. And then if you want to take it yet one more step further to politics, there's really interesting studies showing, for example, that people have different memories about political events, and they're more likely to remember bad things about the other party than bad things about their own party or leaders. And so our brain is selectively remembering and encoding certain pieces of information in ways that reinforce and affirm our priors and our identities.
So we have this sort of hardwiring for confirmation bias, is what you're saying?
Yeah, it's confirmation bias, but it's confirmation bias oriented around whatever identity we have at the moment. You know, again, the same person at a sports stadium might be thinking through the lens of, are they a Yankees fan or a Red Sox fan? And then they turn on the TV and watch a political debate, and all of a sudden a different identity is being used to filter and carve up the world.
Okay, so does that mean that most of the time that we actually... We have a difficult time telling fact from fiction because so much of it is mediated through, as you're saying, these identities that we course in and out of, the groups that we're part of. I mean, is that what you're saying?
Yeah. So I'll give you a really interesting example of why that matters, the identity piece. So there's a great neuroscience study by Sam Harris and colleagues, and they had people kind of get counter evidence for certain beliefs that they had. And then they saw, did they update their belief? And when it was simple beliefs that had nothing to do with politics, people updated their belief really efficiently. So if you tell them, you know, they think they should take a vitamin every day and you challenge that, they update and maybe realize, oh, I don't need to do it, or it doesn't have as much of an effect as I thought. But if you challenge their political beliefs, people don't update nearly as much. They get incredibly resistant to updating those specific types of beliefs. And when they looked inside the brain as people were doing this, they found that parts of the brain involved in a kind of a visceral emotional response, like the insula and amygdala, were really robustly activated for people who were super resistant to changing their beliefs. And so triggering or challenging people's political beliefs, people who are very politically invested, triggers an emotional response, and they don't update as much. They are more resistant.
Oh, this is so interesting because, I mean, let's talk a little bit more about the role the amygdala plays here, or essentially emotion as one of the powerful mediators for what we accept to be true or not. Because I was reading some other studies coming out of the University College of London, for example, where researchers, they basically... for a certain group of test subjects, they excited the people's amygdalas. They gave them some kind of emotional excitement, and then handed them a piece of information which was not true. It was like fake news, essentially. And I think they found that folks were far more likely to believe the fake news if they were already in an emotionally heightened state.
Yeah. So there's also research looking at millions of people and sharing online. And what they found is fake news spreads faster and farther than the truth, but particularly when it has an emotional content to it. And we found the same thing, especially when those emotions are morally tinged. That's the type of language that goes viral online, and it becomes a vehicle for spreading false information.
So we are all at the risk of having our brains be hijacked by, or our ability to discern truth from fiction being hijacked by just the fact that we're also emotional creatures?
Yeah, people are exploiting the quirks in our primitive social and emotional brains, unfortunately.
This is very depressing, but we'll talk a little bit later in the show about how to push back against that. But Jay, if I may ask, now, honestly, truthfully, since this is an hour about truth, I mean, you study this, you understand how the brain works, you're an expert in this field. even someone like you, have you ever accidentally been duped by fake news or spread fake news? I hate that term. So something that wasn't true. Let me just put it that way.
Yeah, I've done it. I share a lot of stuff on Twitter and Facebook. So I've done it at least three times where I've shared something. And then the interesting thing is the community I'm in of my friends and my colleagues that follow me are a lot of them are scientists. And so the norm in the scientific community is if someone shares something false, you immediately correct it. You don't let it slide. So within minutes each time, one of my colleagues jumps in and corrected it, and I was horrified and took it down. And so I have a similar brain to the average person, so I'm going to be kind of sucked into some things. But at least I have a community where the norms are about skepticism and fact-checking and correction. And so it ends up being one of those things that it's not just whether you believe something and enough to share it, but will you be checked by the people in your community? And if so, then you update and correct what you share and what you believe much faster.
And you're much more likely to do that, like you said, if it's from coming within your community. Absolutely fascinating. Yes. So, Jay, hang on for just a second. Let's go to a call. Let's go to John, who's calling from Omaha, Nebraska. John, you're on the air.
Yeah, I was wondering, you're talking about perception of truth and lies. Well, what happens to your brain when you're reading, listening to or watching something that's fiction? You know it's not true, but...
Yeah.
Okay, so your brain handle that?
Yeah. Okay, John, thank you for that question. Jay, go ahead.
Yeah, so the brain, this is the thing about great fiction, especially great writers. They can make you feel like you're in the situation. They can create a vivid picture. And so your brain starts acting as if it's a reality. And that's why people get frustrated when they're watching a movie and the plot just doesn't cohere, because they actually want to transport themselves to a fictitious world and suspend disbelief. So part of fiction is we actively allow ourselves to participate in the fiction. And so that is something that the writer is signaling that they're doing and the person who's reading it or watching a movie is engaging in. But I read an interesting study from a colleague of mine who showed images from movies where they're actually more or less reality focused. So I think it was a Waking Life, which was normal filming versus almost like an animation of the same scenes. And when it's actually looks like a real movie versus an animation, the brain actually processes it more robustly in areas of the brain involved in social cognition. So it does seem like fiction also has layers. It can be more or less real to us, depending on the way that it's presented.
It makes me wonder, Jay, given that the brain is possibly, it's the most complex sort of biological system we could choose to study. Do you run into a problem when you're sliding people into those MRIs that they know they're part of a study, that they may be asked to process something that is not true, that's fake? Like, is the observer tainting the observation, is what I'm asking. Are the brains prepped to maybe be more critical of information than they otherwise might be?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question, and it's true. Some people have said psychology and neuroscience of humans is the hardest science. We don't just get to put something in a petri dish and manipulate it. The problem is that our participants are actively aware of the fact that they're in a study, and they're often trying to anticipate what we want from them. So we try to make the situation as realistic as possible. We also have cover stories that we use to, to direct their attention to something else so we can get their more natural reactions. Another thing we have to do is create a double-blind experiment so they don't know exactly what we're studying, and we often don't know what condition they're in. So we're not doing subtle things to influence them. So there's a lot of scientific craft that goes into designing a study to get those spontaneous reactions. And then another advantage of using neuroscience is that people might be able to fake a reaction on a questionnaire, but it's much harder for them to fake their reaction in certain brain regions. And so we can kind of get a peek underneath the hood at what's going on in a way that people feel is harder to fake. And that allows us kind of deeper insights into what's going on in their mind.
Okay. Well, so we've talked about how the brain processes things that are real or truth. And I want to now explore what happens when brains simply will not accept what's true, that they, in fact, will full-blown deny it even after fact after fact after fact has been presented. You know, we're talking about maybe conspiracy theories, just full-blown denialism. And so I just want to play a short mix of some voices we put together which represent this particular mode of human cognition.
Those iconic blue marble images seen from space, flat earthers denounce them as fakes.
You know, fake news on Facebook, of which, you know, it's a very small amount of the content, influence the election in any way, I think, is a pretty crazy idea.
All of this with the global warming and that, a lot of it's a hoax. It's a hoax. I mean, it's a money-making industry, okay? It's a hoax. A lot of it.
And for every day that the media says vaccines do not cause autism, every day that injection is going into children and damaging more and more and more babies. It has to stop.
And when you tell me that, you know, he should testify because he's going to tell the truth and he shouldn't worry, well, that's so silly because it's somebody's version of the truth, not the truth.
Well, joining us now is Adrian Barden. He's a professor of philosophy at Wake Forest University and author of The Truth About Denial, Bias and Self-Deception in Science, Politics, and Religion. He's joining us from Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and his article, Humans Are Hardwired to Dismiss Facts That Don't Fit Their Worldview, that appeared on theconversation.com, and we have a link to it at onpointradio.org. Adrian Barden, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So we're hardwired to reject the truth? What do you mean? Tell me more.
Well, first of all, it goes back to what Dr. Van Bavel was saying about our evolutionary history, our groupishness, the fact that we evolved in these small groups where social success had at least as much to do with survival and reproduction as having an accurate picture of reality. So that's absolutely right. And, you know, consequently, we've evolved a certain flexibility when it comes to belief. We're not reasoning machines. We're not computers that just calculate and spit out the right results. We're able to adapt our beliefs to our situation, our environment, our needs. And so what we call reasoning, and what even in our own minds, when we think we're reasoning, we're often really rationalizing. We're acting more like lawyers trying to win a case than like, you know, scientists trying to reach the truth. There's been a lot of social science research across many different fields in this area over the last 10 years, a lot. And one of the biggest takeaway from that is that it's like climate science denial, denialism and denial and believing fake news is not a matter of being ignorant of the facts or of the expert consensus. We have many, many studies that show that polarization on politicized science issues like climate, for example, is greater for the well-educated and the more scientifically literate. College-educated Republicans are more likely to be climate science deniers than non-college. And what this is telling us is that the more information you have, the more sophisticated you are, that's just the more ammunition you have to rationalize the conclusion that you wanted to believe anyway.
We see the exact same thing in terms of people who are opposed to vaccines, don't we?
Yes, we do. And the fact is it's not really a calculation that's going on there. Somehow communities have sprung up in which there are certain things that are right to believe. There are certain communities where being skeptical about vaccine safety is the right thing to believe. I mean, we define ourselves in terms of our cultural identifications.
Yeah.
That's what our self-concept is. If somebody asks you, okay, who are you? Tell me about yourself. You're likely to tell them about your family background, your church, and things that you believe in that you share with like-minded persons. I'm an evangelical Christian. I'm an environmentalist. I'm a Latino child of undocumented immigrants. And then when some information comes in, some message comes in that threatens your identity group's beliefs, it therefore feels like a personal attack. And we respond automatically and emotionally to being attacked. And we will then engage in, as you said, confirmation bias. We reject evidence or expert testimony is not credible in favor of what we do like, and we do that unconsciously and automatically.
Well, we have a lot more to dig into about denialism when we come back. So Adrian Barden and Jay Van Bavel, hang on here for just a moment. This is part two of our special four-part series on the truth. And today we are looking at what actually happens in your brain when it's trying to process truth, trying to tell truth from fiction. We have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about how our brains process truth. It's part two in our special series about truth, where we're taking a look at this concept from all sorts of disciplines to help us understand better what is truth, what do we believe, how do we believe it, and what are the implications to the answers to all those questions in the world we live in today. I'm joined by Jay Van Bavel. He's an associate professor of psychology and neuroscience at New York University. And Adrian Barden also joins us. He's a professor of philosophy at Wake Forest University. And we've got comments coming in online here. Christine says the reason that amygdala activation leads us to believe more easily is because it is the first step in our threat detection system. If we're primed for fear, it makes sense that we should change our beliefs more quickly. Jay Van Bavel, let me turn back to you on that. Is Christine right, or are we more primed to actually further entrench ourselves in our belief?
Yeah, so the research with the amygdala finding suggests it's about entrenchment. So people who are having that emotional negative reaction to a challenge are likely to be more likely to resist updating their beliefs. But I think she's getting at something really important, which is that if we're talking about now sharing information online, things that travel well have emotional language in them. And so that is the case where I think threat response or threatening language can lead to something spreading wildly. And you could see this right now with the coronavirus. Fear of a pandemic has led to all kinds of spreading of conspiracy theories and false ideas online. And so basically our emotional system is doing multiple things. It's resisting information we don't like and also triggering us to panic and share things that we might believe in, but that freak us out.
Well, let's go back to our phones. Let's go to Tom, who's calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Tom, you're on the air.
Hi. I'd like, a clarification. If the topic for discussion is the processing of truth, I think of my understanding would be more that it's really processing information, and then it's comparing it in the mind for different things that we think are valid. So it's the perception of truth.
Tom, that's a good point. Let's go back to Adrian Barden on that. Adrian, what do you think?
Well, I think we should bring the media in on this a little bit. We're in the middle of this great democratic experiment where we live in this media environment where citizens can pick and choose their sources of authoritative information about the world. And, well, shockingly, it turns out that we're happier having our prejudices confirmed than having, you know, hearing the harsh reality about something. When you watch or read or listen to something that is conflicting with your worldview, it feels bad. I mean, your stress chemicals go up. It feels stressful and upsetting. Everyone's had this experience. I Fox News, MSNBC, Rush Limbaugh, or NPR. It's a big emotional response, a difference in emotional response in terms of what you're listening to. Now there's conspiracist ideation, right? So conspiracy theories kind of feed into. There's a great phrase from Josh Marshall at Talking Points Memo. He talks about how fake news and conspiracy theories like, you know, Hillary Clinton, you know, running a child pornography ring out of a pizza restaurant, it functions as he puts it, as a kind of ideational pornography. These are claims that excite people's fears and desires and, importantly, enhance their feeling of connection with like-minded persons. Mm-hmm. Do you remember? I think it was during the World Series. So Donald Trump shows up at a baseball game, and the crowd boos him. Mm. Do you recall that video clip? I probably watched that 10 times. Why did I watch that 10 times? I was just enjoying it, and I love to talk to my friends about it, and we all enjoyed it together. And that's and again, human beings are very social. We're social animals, and that has a huge influence on our behavior and our subconscious or unconscious strategic decisions about what to believe and what to take to be true.
Right, and I presume or I imagine that many folks out there who support the president may have also watched that clip 10 times, not because they enjoyed it, but because it inflamed their anger about how the president had been treated. That also produced an emotional response, which might have prepped them for accepting all manner of information. But yes. Jay, so Adrian's saying something really interesting. And in fact, he's written, I'm just going to read a quote here, that Adrian writes, "It turns out that one's political, religious, or ethnic identity quite effectively predicts one's willingness to accept expertise on any given politicized issue." And we've talked about this for a little bit, but Jay, dare I ask, are there any genetic causes for this? Are there any heritable aspects of where one might fall on the political spectrum?
Yeah, so there is research with twins, comparing identical twins versus non-identical twins. And it suggests that people's tendency to be liberal or conservative, about 40% of that is predicted by biology. So if you have an identical twin, you're far more likely to share their political beliefs than if you have a non-identical twin, even if you're raised in the exact same home and the exact same parents. So this creates what my colleague John Jost calls a political affinity, which means that from a young age, you are attracted, you have an orientation towards the world that might be different from somebody on the opposite side of the political spectrum. And it attracts you to certain types of, you develop a certain personality type. You're attracted to certain leaders and party platforms and policies that just resonate with you for some deep reason that you might not be able to articulate why. So that turns out to be a big part of the political discussion, and it ends up often being completely overlooked. We assume we can just convince people with rhetoric and reason and factual information. But if the underlying resistance to the information is something about their personality and biological orientation, some messages might be hard to get through to them unless you frame it in a way that resonates with that style.
Mm. Now, I mean, we all walk through the world as sort of multifactorial beings, right? It's not just one thing that determines how we see the world. But what are the implications, Jay, if a portion of our of the way we process information is somewhat heritable? I mean, what are the implications for that?
So one is that you have to understand that a lot of reasoning and argumentation and normal political ads probably aren't going to be effective. And lots of research suggests they're not super effective. The second thing I alluded to is that if some people have a different orientation towards the world, you're going to have an awareness of what that is if you want to convince them or persuade them. So really cool research on this coming out of Stanford University in Berkeley found that if you talk about something like ruining the environment, liberals talk about it through the lens of like harming the environment. And that's something that resonates with liberals. But messaging around that resonates more with conservatives is about spoiling or making the environment more disgusting or less pure because they're more concerned about purity issues. And so taking the exact same concern about it, you know, cleaning up or improving the environment and framing it in a different way is going to resonate with different audiences. And it's the same thing for conservative issues around like the military. If they frame it in terms of preventing harm, liberals are going to resonate more with it than if they frame it in terms of loyalty and protecting their in-group, which are conservative leaning issues. So that's something that's going to be really critical once you start with the basis that there are personality and biological and moral differences between people at different parts of the political spectrum, and they're not all the same. Then you need to step back and think of a different type of strategy for getting through to them.
Mm. Adrian Barden, your thoughts on that?
Well, there's a lot of talk and a lot of research in the area of science communication about framing. Which is essentially kind of advertising. You're advertising issues in ways that will appeal to certain audiences. And that's right. You know, And in the same vein, people have proposed what are sometimes called in-group messengers. That is to say, you want the message to be delivered by someone that, that the group feels is one of them, is you know, part of their ideological group. The most famous example is the wonderful evangelical Christian climate scientist Catherine Hayhoe. And she goes around and talks to different audiences, mostly, you know, folks like herself, purposely, and talks to them about climate in terms of creation care and doing God's work. And the hope is that we'll get better results. I have to say I'm a little bit pessimistic about that, because these are like temporary interventions that are going up against this huge wave of a whole lifetime of cultural identifications and loyalties. And I mean, you know, one positive interaction is like a fart in a windstorm. There's been tons of messaging for many years about the scientific consensus on climate, but the opinion among the groups that are already antagonistic to the concept hasn't changed much at all. The climate issue is like a perfect storm for the conservative personality and for conservative ideology, where conservatives by definition favor status quo economic and social arrangements. And climate science is a form of science that represents this massive threat to the existing social and economic order. It threatens the status quo. It threatens demographic identity groups invested in the status quo. And we see the highest levels of climate science denial amongst white men. And they are conservative Christian white men have benefited the most from the status quo historically, and they're most invested in it. Any solution to climate is going to require massive government intervention. There's no small government solution to global environmental problems. So this is particularly threatening to the especially individualistic small government aspects of American conservative ideology. And having a little bit of advertising, it's the right idea in principle, but I'm concerned about whether it's really going to be effective.
Well, let's get one more call in here while we can. Andrew is calling from Thompson, Pennsylvania. Andrew, you're on the air.
Yes, I really appreciate this discussion. However, I think truth is the wrong word. It's about reality, how we perceive reality. And in Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow, and the research he's done over the past 40 years, he makes the distinction that we have two ways of responding to everything in our lives. And one is our first emotion is our reflexive, instinctive, and emotional response. And secondarily is our critical, analytic thinking, which is slower, which then often does a correction on our first decision we make. There is confirmation bias. We tend to support the evidence that confirms our biases, i.e. our initial response. And there's also negative bias in that we're more inclined to believe negative information than positive information. And that's all I wish to say. Thank you.
Well, Andrew, thank you so much for your call. Jay, do you want to respond to Andrew?
Yeah. So there's lots of people studying that in the domain of issues like fake news and misinformation. And they found evidence consistent with what Andrew just mentioned from Danny Kahneman's book, which is that people who score higher on analytic thinking or people who are forced to take more time to consider something are able to sometimes sort out the difference between reality and fiction. And so that is part of the tool set that we should all bring when we're engaging in evaluations of news or sharing information on the media. You might want to think twice before you share something. And again, I share also Adrian's concern about the scalability or impact of some of these issues. And that's why I think that there is also a burden on institutions. So, for example, social media companies could retweak or tune their programming and change their platform instantly in ways that change how billions of people will share information and engage with reality and facts online. They could make it so that you have a deliberation or a prompt to get you thinking about what you share, given the evidence that suggests that works.
And right, then but they won't do that. They've actively said they won't, right? Because it would reduce engagement. I mean, that's how they make their money.
Yeah, so it's a cost for them financially. Yeah. But I'm just saying that the solutions here aren't just necessarily going door to door and trying to convince somebody. If you can change the platforms, you can scale it instantaneously to billions of people in a way that we never could before.
Well, so listen, tomorrow on the show, we are going to talk about how these basic biological and social functions that all of us as human beings have, how they've been hijacked over time, like you said, by the media and especially by political leaders in order to really sort of control and shape behavior and history. That's what we're going to look at tomorrow. And so in the last minute that we have, Adrian, let me ask this of you. I mean, we have explored how basically it seems like our brains are primed to be really good at being social animals. Emotion is a big part of how we perceive what we believe and want to know as true. We have this self-identifying political problem, which some might somewhat be influenced by genes, as Jay was saying to us. Now, short of social media doing something about slowing down the rate of information and politicians, you know, all of a sudden deciding to not want to manipulate these facts about us anymore, I don't see that happening either. What can we as individuals do, knowing what we know about how our minds work, to you know, get a better hold on accepting things that are true?
Well, I mean, we are capable of self-awareness, and you can really make a concerted effort to, if you're on Twitter, to you know, follow some hopefully reasonable voices that you wouldn't normally agree with. Short-term solutions. I think we should talk to other people and try to identify common ground. I mean, one of the areas where we've seen a little bit of progress on thinking about climate change is by not using those words. And we talk to our local community and we say, hey, flooding is a problem here.
Right.
Let's talk about flooding. That's an issue we all care about. That's an issue that we share. And so now you're part of the same group, and now you can have more, by depoliticizing the issue, you can have maybe a more constructive conversation.
And so making connections with people, I think also slowing down before reacting to give our brains actually a little bit of time to process that information past the initial emotional response, maybe that'll help too. Those are two things to start with, but we'll continue the conversation and the exploration tomorrow in the third part of our series. So Adrian Barden, professor of philosophy at Wake Forest University and author of The Truth About Denial, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Jay Van Bavel, a professor of psychology and neuroscience at New York University. It was great to have you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.